OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in at home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power.
Remember sport? That thing you used to love? It's back.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Well, later on in the football show, we'll talk to Jerry Armstrong, who is obviously right across La Liga. Real Madrid, 2 points from winning the title. They will play tomorrow evening and should win the title ahead of Barcelona. They started lockdown, or they ended, they began their Project Restart, as the Spanish version was, behind Barcelona. But with Barca struggling, Real have cruised through and they're now on the cusp of winning La Liga. As for Gareth Bale, he's been on the bench 5 games in a row. It would seem his relationship with Zinedine Zidane is as fractious as ever. And he was pretending to be asleep in the stands for one game. For another game, he was pretending to watch the game through binoculars. I'm not really sure exactly why, but it's aggravated the Real Madrid fan base, who are already not so sure about Bale, to say the least. So we'll talk to Jerry about all of that later on, and just where Bale's standing at the club is. His contract goes to 2022. Very shortly, we'll talk to Adam Pope. He is of BBC Leeds, who themselves are on the cusp of a return to the Premier League. They have a game tomorrow, which should pretty much, give or take, all but see them home. They have been away from the Premier League for 16 seasons, and now they are potentially coming back under Marcelo Bielsa. So we'll talk to Adam Pope. I'm sure they're pretty happy in Leeds. Before all that, though, full times from the Premier League this evening, if you didn't catch the results. Manchester City were up against Bournemouth. This was at the Etihad, as was Peter Smith.
A battle won off the pitch on Monday for City, and another win on the field, and a 10th consecutive Premier League success over Bournemouth, with a now aggregate scoreline of 30-5. After strikes from David Silva and Gabriel Jesus, City didn't expend much energy in the second half, and they almost paid the price with a late Bournemouth rally. A substitute, David Brooks, offered genuine hope. Battling qualities they'll need going into their final two games still cut adrift in the relegation zone. City 2, Bournemouth 1.
Result of the evening probably came at St James's Park. Stephen Goldsmith there.
Newcastle 1, Tottenham 3. Jose Mourinho has finally won a league game at Newcastle after 15 years, 8 games and 3 different clubs. He looked to the bench in despair at one point during the game when an out-of-sorts looking Harry Kane made a hash of a chance. But Kane is a deadly striker and proceeded to put 2 headers away, adding to Son's first half goal and restoring their lead after Richie had levelled things up. Newcastle 1, Tottenham 3.
The other early game was a turf moor. It was Burnley against Wolves. Adam Jory was at that game.
Wolves' bid for a top four finish now looks to be in tatters after being held by Burnley. In truth, they didn't really do enough in the match to warrant all 3 points, but Jimenez's strike appeared to be the winner. It looked as though Burnley's mounting injuries amidst the rigorous schedule had finally took its toll as they failed to find another gear. But Chris Wood, who moments earlier had missed a sitter, scored a penalty under pressure that may well have handed them an outside chance in their own bid for European football with just 2 games to go.
There we are. That is the roundup of the 3 early games in the Premier League. As things stand, just before the break at the Emirates, we've had another goal and it's gone the way of Arsenal. Nelson has scored in the 44th minute. Arsenal were 1-0 down in this game. Mane had scored in 20 minutes. Lacazette equalised on 32 minutes. And now Nelson has scored to make it 2-1 Arsenal, and it's just gone half-time. So Arsenal in the lead against Liverpool this evening at the Emirates. Let's turn to Leeds United. Adam Pope of BBC Leeds is with us. Evening, Adam.
Hey, Joe.
So you're all happy. Things are moving very nicely. The results you wanted this evening didn't quite go the way Leeds would have liked, in that Brentford beat Preston. So what exactly do Leeds have to do, and how likely are they to mess it up at this stage?
Well, there's two very, very different questions. Yeah. I mean, firstly, we were sort of hoping that, probably against hope, that Brentford would slip up tonight, because it meant that would have meant that Leeds could have gone up tomorrow. As it stands, they can't mathematically with a win over Barnes tomorrow night, who are the bottom club, of course. What it does mean, though, Joe Whitley, if Leeds did win against Barnes tomorrow, then they could actually get promoted without kicking another ball before they get to Derby on Sunday, because it means there's no margin for error for West Brom, who play at Huddersfield on Friday night, nor for Brentford, who play at Stoke on Saturday in the lunchtime kickoff. So, yeah, a win tomorrow night, as you say, virtually has them there. They need 4 points or somehow to get a 4-point advantage over those two rivals in the next three games. You think they'd do it, but it's Leeds, Joe.
There's always a twist.
There is, Joe, but I mean, this year, to my mind, they have become the best team, not just the most attractive team, they've become the best team in 25 wins so far. They are in really, really good form. They just had that little blip at the beginning of the restart against Cardiff, which was nothing more than a bit of rustiness. But since then, they've been pretty overwhelming, very unlucky to drop 2 points at home to Luton. And then against Swansea, fantastic last-minute win. Just wish the fans were there for it. And, you know, demolished Stoke. Did really well against Fulham, despite being on the back foot, even at 1-0 up. But Pablo Hernandez has been the man. Three 45-minute cameos for him, Joe. And he's totally put this season back in Leeds United's hands, if it wasn't already.
Mm. Are they a markedly better side this year than last?
I think they're stronger. I think they're more robust. They play exactly the same way, Joe. And it's pretty much the same players, is it not? You know, Patrick Bamford, still up front. You know, he gets criticised for missing a lot of chances, but he's only one shy of his record total in the Championship. He's on 16 at the moment. He had 17 with Middlesbrough. Sadly, Calvin Phillips is injured for the rest of the season. He's been an absolute mainstay. They call him the Yorkshire Pirlo here. That's been his influence and his maturity in the way that he's developed under Marcelo Bielsa. So very, very much the same squad. If you're looking at the new players that have come in, it's Ben White has been a phenomenon. Pontus Janssen went to Brentford, where he's doing a great job, of course. But Ben White, if they could keep him, should they go up, then they have a Premier League quality player right there. He's been superb. But, you know, if you're picking a man of the season, Stuart Dallas has kicked on again. I mean, 9 out of 10 every week, and has become a consummate defender, having arrived as a winger. There you go. Same players, had 2 years of Bielsa, and now some of them look like they're Premier League ready.
Mm. How are Leeds United finances these days? Have they spent big over the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years to get to this position, Bielsa aside?
Do you know what? Their finances, in terms of FFP or PNS, they were on the cusp, but they've handled it quite well. And I'll give you an example there. The club still loses money, so Radrizzani, the owner, still has to, you know, write a check out to keep funding the losses, despite having, what, £50 million revenues, or that's what it will be next time around. The wage bill's gone up, you know, massively. It's gone up from, if you remember Cellino's days, that was sort of like £12-13 million sort of year. Now, all things considered, you're up near £40 million. Mm. And that is sort of what they felt that they needed to do if they were to compete right at the top end of the Championship. So it does lose money. But however you think, if they go up, then the revenues that come, obviously, as we know, with the broadcast rights, the commercial rights, everything else, will soon see Leeds into a profit. So they're a pretty clean club these days compared to where they were a long time ago. They were saddled with huge debts for a long, long time, but Radrizzani's whittled them down well, to be fair.
Okay, that's well and truly behind them. So, I mean, a Premier League spot for a start is £100 million in the bank. It's celebration time. It's just incredible amount of revenue to receive overnight. Will they spend big, do we suspect?
Well, I don't think they will. And sort of the example that I'll give you there would be, like, say, Helder Costa. They bought him over a period of time from Wolves. He's going to be £16 million in the summer. And what they did, instead of buying him, say, for £14 or £15 million sort of straight up, they made sure that the impact falls into the next year, so that if they were to stay in the Championship, then it means that they won't be hammered when it comes to FFP next time around. So I don't think they'll be spending, you know, hundreds of millions like Aston Villa did on players. I think they need to spend on a keeper. They need two more strikers, I would say. We don't know what's going to happen with Augustin, the guy from Leipzig who's loan ended, and we understand that there is an obligation to buy him should they get promoted, but he's featured for 45 minutes. That could be £18 million. Could be down the drain if they have to pay it, if he isn't going to come back or if he isn't going to perform. And I think, you know, they're probably going to need another number 10, because Hernandez he's brilliant, but can he still do it for another year at 35, going on 36 into the Premier League? So a new spine is what they'll need, but I don't think they'll be spending massive, Joe, to be quite honest. I really don't.
Mm. When we've talked to you over the last couple of years with Bielsa and with Leeds falling short, we have maybe wondered if tiredness had hit the squad. And you, I don't think, have been of the opinion that that was the issue. Now, this season, obviously, the pandemic intervened, and so we don't know to what extent they may or may not have benefited from a rest. So that will still, for the begrudgers out there, that will still be a question mark next season.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't agree with it, as you know, because the stats show differently. And Bielsa's talked at length to us about that, saying everybody's still running harder, faster, longer, quicker, stronger than the opposition. Last year, I think it was more of a case of they just imploded at a crucial time. You know, it was just handling the pressure of it all, really, in a mad 20 minutes. If you think about it, Joe, ahead of the break, you know, they drew at Brentford and then they won their next five games without conceding a goal. Mm. So they went into the suspension because of COVID in really good form. And to be fair, they've come out of it bar that one game where they looked a little bit sluggish. And to be fair, in recent games, you can see the Championship is taking its toll with these nine games in such a quick succession. But I still think they are a massively fit side. I mean, they overwhelmed Fulham in the second half. They battered Stoke the other week. And look, one of my moments of the season, Joe, and this sums up the fitness, Luke Ayling picks the ball up, 90th minute at Swansea. He's on his own goal line. He receives a short pass from the goalkeeper, puffs his cheeks, pulls the oxygen in, legs it up the right wing, big 1-2, cut back, and Hernandez scores. That's the difference between Leeds and the other side. That's what makes you champions.
Mm. And I know you've always been very strong on that point, and I haven't had a strong opinion either way because I'm not watching them week in, week out to have that kind of an opinion. But if nothing else, you would say, well, these players have adjusted to Bielsa demands at this stage anyway, if there was an initial issue.
Yeah, they have. And like I said before, you know, you're 2 years in now, so they know what to expect. It's still very difficult. It's still the murder ball sessions that we talked about, I think, last time I was on, where they play intense 11 against 11. You know, something during the suspension, of course, they were gagging to get back to. But it really is a tough and strenuous regime. And if you don't get up to speed, and it's very difficult for players coming in January. Look at Jean-Kevin Augustin, you know, coming in from Leipzig, you know, via Monaco. He's not got down to the weight. He took an injury in February, maybe has recovered, but has just not got into the rhythm of it, and hence his services are not needed at this time. And that just shows you how difficult it is to get up to speed halfway through a season. You really do need that pre-season with Bielsa, I feel, and you know, to be able to sort of match his standards.
Mm. So I presume Elland Road is rocking these days. Is it full houses? Are the good times back? Is there a sense of excitement about the whole thing? There must be.
Well, there wasn't until we couldn't have the fans back in, of course. Yeah. And this is the great sadness. Yeah, I mean, we've noticed it more as I do the commentary with Noel Whelan, the ex-player with Leeds. And he's a lively guy. And I'm glad for it because he helps fill, you know, an echoey bowl. And the last game we did away at Swansea in particular, whether it was the acoustics more than anything, it was really noticeable that, you know, there was no fans to celebrate Hernandez scoring a late winner. Similarly at Blackburn, where, you know, Calvin Phillips scored an absolutely wonderful goal. And normally you turn away to what they call the Darwin end of Blackburn, and there's 8,000 Leeds fans traditionally make that journey across the Pennines into Lancashire. That has been a huge miss. And also the other thing, as we know, you know, Big Jack has died, Big Norman has died, Trevor Cherry has died, and the fans haven't been there to be able to pay their respects. You know, the flags are there inside the stadium. Leeds have been really classy in how they've done it, and so have other clubs too, and particularly around Big Jack, you know, this last weekend. And it's been really, so on two fronts, it's been really noticeable and really poignant and really sad that this, what should be one of the greatest moments in the club's history, cannot be celebrated in the proper way.
Pre-pandemic, what was it like at Elland Road this season?
Oh, Joe, awesome. I mean, it's been Bielsa, without trying to court the headlines or court the publicity, you know, he wants it to reflect off his players onto the fans, if you like, you know, all the sort of goodness. He has re-engaged the city and got everybody just so on side with the club. I mean, there were other times before, you know, Gary Monk managed to do it for a good while too before that season is sort of petered out. But Bielsa's done it in such a way that is absolutely adored and revered. People are so proud of their football club. I mean, I'm not saying that they always weren't, but seriously, the amount of shirts that are worn, the amount of pride people take in their club, the way that they talk about the way the football's played and how they love this head coach, who they just think is already a legend, you know. And if you can just get this over the line, then this club is ready to explode. It really is. And come back, you know, with all its swagger, it's all as, you know, nobody likes us, we don't care sort of attitude back into the Premier League, where, let's face it, they might not like them, but they do want them.
No, absolutely. They're a brilliant story to have back in the league. I'm not sure when you first pitched up at Leeds or worked in Leeds, but I would think post the incredible fall, that just self-combustion, I would presume there would have been many in the city absolutely livid with the football club and angry at the football club.
There was a phrase used, and I think it's some of the Twitter handle called Fear and Loathing in LS11, the postcode of Beeston where it is. And under the Bates regime, for Ken Bates regime, for quite a significant period, and also under Massimo Cellino too, one of the previous owners, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of infighting. You know, fans groups were having to literally take to march in the city centre to the ground to try and force some change. Football was awful. There was one, I'm trying to think now, since I started doing it in 05-06 when they lost to that in the playoff final to Watford at Cardiff, the Millennium Stadium, there's probably been one season of real note in that time, and that was beating Manchester United in the FA Cup in under Simon Grayson, the same year that they made it up out of League One into the Championship on the last day in typical sort of Leeds style, if you like. So other than that, there's been so little other than 2 7th place finishes in last year's, you know, playoff defeat to Derby, which was utter heartache. So it's time, and they deserve it. They really do. These fans deserve it because their support is superb, Joe. And if anybody goes to Element, I know loads come across from Ireland. It is absolutely unique, not just there, but when they go away too. They really make everything an event. And it's great because as a commentator, Joe, and you'll know this as well, you sort of ride off the crowd too and the vibe that you get. And all that isn't there at the moment. And it's particularly noticeable with Leeds.
No, I'm sure. And what of Bielsa in the midst of all of this and across the season generally? I wouldn't say he's made massive headlines. There's certainly been no Spygate this year, that's for sure. How has he been week to week?
Yeah, you're right. There hasn't been any of that sort of off-field stuff to affect him. The only thing I would say that's has been, and it's not really him either, it was, of course, the Kiko Casillas situation, who was, by the FA, found him guilty of, racially abusing the Charlton striker, or the Charlton loanee striker, Jonathan Lecco. He's actually available to play now. His ban's finished and is available to play tomorrow. So that's probably the only big off-field issue that Leeds are sort of having to contend with. But as far as Bielsa is concerned, no, there's been no Spygate. There's been nothing at all contentious. And he has just carried on in the same way, his own humble way. And I tell you what, he's handled the whole COVID crisis really, really sort of low-key. The whole return with, you know, 9 games in a short period of time, having to play last after all the rivals again. I mean, this will be the second time in a row, and then the third time will be on Sunday at Derby too. And he handles all that so well, never makes an excuse out of that or the referees or anything that goes against him. Conducts himself with utter, utter class. And I've got to say, Joe, this season, if he couldn't have done it any more last season, it's just added so much more value into the squad. You know, Ben White, who's on loan from Brighton, and Calvin Phillips, genuinely being talked about by Gareth Southgate in dispatches with regards to next year's European Championships.
He does improve players, Bielsa, doesn't he?
Joe, he does. Look, immeasurably so. I think Calvin Phillips is the one. And it's so sad that the local lad won't be able to see out the last 3 games. He has become the ultimate defensive midfielder. Breaks up, starts stuff, passes stuff, gets the odd goal. He's brilliant. What he's done with him, he's found him the position that others were almost there with, because he's played at the top of a diamond, he's played in midfield, etc. But he can play defensive midfield and as a sort of auxiliary centre-back as well. And he's just got it out of him from the start. And that is probably the finest bit of coaching I've seen. But Stuart Dallas, I'm not joking, he is a defender now. Whereas when he first had to defend, when he was sort of put in as a makeshift, it was a real struggle for him. But he is a superb defender and is holding down left-back in particular really, really well, and is keeping Barry Douglas, who's an out-and-out left-back, Gianni Alioski, the Macedonian international, who started as a winger but is a left-back for his country. Dallas is quite rightly keeping them out, because he's been turned into a superb defender by the coach.
Mm. Every time you're on, I do a quick Google of Marcelo Bielsa just to see if he's said anything of interest or check in what's going on. And invariably, somewhere on that first page of Google, I find a new article which tells me stuff about Bielsa I didn't know. And it's always just amazingly colourful. So TalkSport had a piece up about him today, and it has nuggets like this. From his days at Newell's Old Boys. Newell's were trashed 6-0 by San Lorenzo in the Copa Libertadores, South America's answer to the Champions League. That night, a gang of 20 incensed ultras turned up at Bielsa's home, demanding he come out to face them. When he emerged at the door, he did so clutching a grenade. "If you don't leave," he said, "I will pull the pin." It was this incident that popularised the nickname for Bielsa, El Loco, the crazy one.
Joe, it's a great story, isn't it?
And tell me it's true. Don't you dare tell me it's not true.
No, it's true. I mean, the El Loco title, which can mean quite a few different things, but obviously to us it means, you know, the mad one. We don't see any of that. I mean, what we see is a humble guy with an iron will to commit himself to his philosophy of how to play football, an aesthetically pleasing style of football, which he hoped, literally, I think, he just wants to bring to the masses. And the masses are the Leeds fans in a traditional sort of northern city, if you like, but a one-club city, and to bring them joy into lives that might otherwise have very little joy. That's how he speaks. That's how he feels. That's how he's so passionate. So I can understand him doing what he did. You know, as you say, walking out with a grenade, I just can't see him doing it now, maybe 20 years ago or 10 years ago when he's seen the footage. But his attitude is, he's like Corinthian. It's like an amateur attitude. He wants his players to play for the love of the game. And that's what is beautiful for him. You know, it's not the winning, really. Winning is a happy byproduct. It's how you win, how you make people better. And if you can make a difference to people's lives, he looks at football in a much more, if you like, global term, rather than I honestly think he's trying to protect the game going forward. You know, he's talked about having to save the game from the world that exists around football at the moment. And we've got to be very careful with it, and that's why you see some of the great humble acts that he does, and the really noble stuff. It's like giving, you know, the goal back to Aston Villa last season, for etc.
Yeah, and his work rate is astounding. I mean, that was one of the ancillary parts to Spygate, was we got a glimpse of the detail he goes into. And you know, famously, I think when the Leeds executive people went over to Argentina to try and secure his services, he had watched every single one of their league fixtures from the previous season. He was able to list formations they used by opponent across a 46-game season. By all accounts, he can watch and analyse two games at once. He's perfected that art. And there is a depth to him. So this piece in TalkSport I mentioned, it said here that when he stood down as coach of Argentina in 2004, he went to live in a monastery with nuns for 3 months without a phone or television. There he read voraciously, reflected on his guilt, frustration and embarrassment at failing to guide the national team to anything greater than an Olympic gold medal. Soon after, he retreated to his farm where he continued to live in relative anonymity for 3 years. During his time away from football bright lights, he continued to study the game. He would take breaks for regular exercise. One day he came across a man whose wife had left him for another and taken all their possessions. Though he was not in need of house workers, Bielsa offered to pay the man to prepare lunch for them both every day until he had enough money to get his life back on track. It goes on in this vein. The point I'm making is he has a depth to him. He has a social conscience to him.
Oh, absolutely he does. And look what he did with his the club he loves, Newell's Old Boys. You know, the way he donated that money to build the, if you like, what we'd probably call an academy or the hotel there, which was named after his great mentor, Jorge Grifo, as well. And that's the sort of measure of the man. You know, this is a man, as you say, who has depth, who paid the Spygate fine himself. Yeah, he wouldn't want anybody to know that. This is the man who thought this would be a great idea if, and again, he didn't want this to get out, but it did, to get the players to pick up litter at the beginning of last season for a length of time that was commensurate with the time that fans would have to work so that they could pay for a ticket to go and watch those very same players play. Who could get away with that unless people bought into him and believed in him? You're right, he has a huge depth. His relationship with the media is, we do it all in one. There's no one-on-one stuff. That's been well documented. His relationship with the fans and the public is incredible. He stops, he gives his time, he'll have selfies, distance as they may be at the moment. He will chat to fans and be very open with them. He's very open with the press, I think, to be honest, too. I love that. There's a transparency about him that you don't see with other coaches. And what I would say, Joe, as well, you can ask him anything on football about why he made substitutions, why he's done this, why he's putting this player there, will he be doing this, using this player in this position? And he will talk to you and discuss, and he does not make you feel like you don't know what you're asking about or talking about. He's great. He wants to talk about the football, and it's really refreshing. What he doesn't like is the constant barrage of some press, I think, in the past, who tried to go for what he calls the polemic and trying to get the divisive sort of, you know, the stuff that's really contentious, or where they're always looking for, you know, a little bit of an abrasive ankle, which will probably come in the Premier League, which will probably come with Leeds United. But I think that's why the relationship with everybody, and particularly the local press, is that we talk about on-pitch stuff, and that's great. It's such a change at Leeds United to be able to do that, Jan.
Well, I mean, like, it's a privilege for you guys to be able to throw Marcelo Bielsa, who Pep has said is the greatest coach in the world, to throw him football questions, that he's willing to answer them and indulge us idiots. I mean, what a privilege. That may be one of the question marks as we begin to wrap up our conversation here, Adam. That may be one of the question marks hanging over how Leeds might do. I don't want to say will do. Let's make sure they qualify for, or they win the championship first. But how they might do in the Premier League next season. Bielsa's temperament under the glare of national media. They will be going for sensational stories. He will be hit with whatever the issue of the day is, and it'll be in Sky Sports News, and any misstep will be magnified. And as we know from his history, he ain't afraid to pack up his bags and walk away at strange moments.
No, and in that light, Joe, we have to enjoy every minute that he's at Leeds United, because he's been a benefit to football in general here. You know, he really has. He's raised the standard. So it is always, I'll be honest, it's in the back of my mind. You know, Lazio, they failed to deliver their promises. He walked out after 2 days. So far, so good. And there's been a few tests on the way, if you think about it, Joe. Ronaldo Vieira, really promising midfielder, was sold literally, you know, weeks into his first summer at Leeds, or just towards the end of that first summer, to Sampdoria. Not an ideal situation. He said that if he'd stayed another year, I would have doubled his value, you know, rather than the 7 million or whatever it was he went for. So he didn't go on the back of that. That was obviously being discussed. Leeds have been straight with him. And then the whole Spygate thing, which you mentioned again before. You know, I as a reporter, I've got to be honest, being objective, I thought the way he was treated was disgusting, because I still don't think he did anything wrong, and to be fined and punished for something that was had no rule or law until retrospectively was really bad. And again, I thought, well, could he walk on the back of that if he's being called a cheat or this, that and the other? He didn't. He stayed and he's seen it through. So, but you're right. I think the times he has got rattled is either when there has been maybe the odd story and he's just completely disagreed, or he feels that he's being mocked. And sometimes that does come down to a mistranslation here or there. And what we have actually said is that we absolutely appreciate the time that you give us to talk about football. When he might consider itself to be a bit technical, a bit boring, we say, no, it's really important. But I think others have sort of mocked him sometimes for the depths that he's gone to. And I think that sometimes has gotten his goat a little bit, with a few other things. But ultimately, no, he's been a real act of class throughout. And I just hope that, you know, if this squad does go into the Premier League, the only way really you can see them actually sort of staying up quite well would be making sure that he stays.
Mm. Well, look, here's hoping we'll have a full house at Elland Road next season, Manchester United in town, the place going ballistic, and, you know, everything that Leeds can bring to the party would be great. Before you go, very finally, you mentioned Big Jack. I mean, there was such an outpouring over here. He's an icon. You know, he really is over here. There was a time he was probably the most famous person in the country, there or thereabouts, for a period. Such a pity that, you know, it wasn't a big crowd at Elland Road to pay some kind of tribute. But in the city, is it, like, here everyone knows him because of the Ireland stuff, and that's more recent. Would a 20, 30 year old be aware of Big Jack and 20 seasons at Leeds?
Yeah, that's interesting. Probably not, in the sense of how revered he was or how much of a part of the great golden age of Leeds he was. People know he was one of the World Cup winners. Mm. They won't, what they won't realise, Joe, is what a really good player he was. He was self-deprecating. Obviously, you've heard him talk in the past. I won the ball and gave it to those that could play sort of attitude. You don't play 773 times for the best side in England for a long, long time, win a World Cup, and then manage at a high level without being very good at playing the sport, because that gives you the kudos to go on to be a really good manager. And all right, it doesn't work for everybody. It didn't work for his brother Bobby. But so the younger generation probably won't get it. For people like me, who's in my early 50s, I don't remember as a player. You know, he was like 73 when he retired. What I remember him was doing coaching on television and being really engaging. And then, of course, we all remember Italia 90 and USA 94. And I mean, phenomenal. And then, you know, to have a statue at Cork, you know, with him fishing. And this guy stands across the IOC as a footballing giant. Mm. And I'm really glad that that has been recognised by so many people. I mean, you know, he met the Pope. You know, he was funny. He was engaging. His grandchildren talk about him in a way that's so glowing, that this, he was a funny sort of giant. He was belligerent. What a guy. I mean, what a career, what a life he had. I mean, it's phenomenal. And to revitalise Ireland or Irish football, or give them, you know, untold heights at that time, you know, that's probably how, like, Chile look at Bielsa, isn't it? For, you know, and to some extent, you know, Argentina as well, you know, for whom he won Olympic gold. This is what you're talking, this is one of football's great, great iconic people. And it's so sad that that we can't, you know, remember him in quite the way that we want to, or pay our respects in the way we want to.
Adam Pope, BBC Leeds. Thanks so much, Adam. Much appreciated.
Good to talk to you, Joe.
Yeah, likewise. So I suspect we'll be talking to Adam a whole lot more across next season once Leeds don't screw this up in spectacular fashion. Should tell you, at the Emirates still, Arsenal 2, Liverpool 1. Liverpool, by the way, I've just seen the goals there while chatting to Adam. They replayed them on the TV. Two disastrous goals to give away. Van Dijk, in the most uncharacteristic fashion, just dispossessed on the edge of the area and a gift of a goal. And then the other Arsenal goal came from a Liverpool throw-in. You know, again, similar situation. They're very near their own penalty area. Throw comes in. They're dispossessed far too easily, and two really bad goals to give away. So 2-1 Arsenal, 61 minutes on the clock. We're talking to Gerry Armstrong about Spanish football next.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. When you've seen West Ham beat Preston in the 1963 FA Cup final for the sixth time, live football is back. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
Welcome back. Still Arsenal 2, Liverpool 1. We're turning to Spanish football. Tomorrow evening, Real Madrid can wrap up La Liga. We have Gerry Armstrong with us. Evening, Gerry.
Hi, good evening, Joe.
So I think we spoke with yourself and Dermot Corrigan just as La Liga was about to restart. At that stage, Madrid were behind Barcelona, and you said to us you had a strong sneaking suspicion that Real Madrid would catch them and overtake them and win the league. So you're sitting pretty right now.
Yeah, well, it was a question of the strongs. I knew Barcelona didn't have as strong a squad as Real Madrid, and Real Madrid certainly had a lot of players who were almost fit coming back after injuries, including the Mallorcan player who has come back and started scoring goals for them. But Benzema's on fire. He's scoring goals for fun. He's only three goals behind Lionel Messi, who's sitting on 22 goals. He's with a cheat sheet. But just think they had a better squad, and there's a lot of problems at Barcelona at the moment. They've dropped points they shouldn't have dropped. And Kike Setien, the manager's under pressure. So it's not been good for Barcelona, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, the story is every bit as much about how bad Barcelona have become by their standards as however good Real Madrid have been, because this has not been a vintage La Liga season.
No, it hasn't. But, you know, one of the goals the other night was scored by Mendy, and he's their 21st goal scorer this season. And it shows you how extensive they are when they've got that quality. One of the star players for Mallorca this season is a guy called Take Kubo, a Japanese player who's 18, 19 years of age and has been sensational. And he was loaned from Real Madrid to, obviously, to Mallorca to play, and he was their outstanding player this season. So they have real strength and depth, whereas I think Barcelona really need to rebuild this summer. And I don't know where that's going to take them, but if they're going to keep in touch with Real Madrid, they certainly have to spend money and get the right players.
And how strong, Gerry, is Real Madrid's first 11? Like, do they have a stellar 11?
Yeah, they've a very straightforward stellar 11. They've got very solid back four. I mean, Sergio Ramos is still a captain. He's an ever-present. I know he's getting older, but he is so consistent. They can interchange the fullbacks at will. They've got a quality midfield. Sometimes they play Modric. Sometimes even Gareth Bale plays. He wasn't playing last night. He was on the bench. But, you know, they've got quite an extensive squad. And I just feel that they've got more quality than anybody else and more strength and depth. And that's why I fancied them to win the league.
So how will they go against Man City then? That's the other question mark. They still have the second leg to play. Well, they're 2-1 down.
Yes, I think obviously Manchester City, after losing the title to Liverpool, will be looking to bounce back. Now, equally so, Manchester City have a fabulous squad. Mm. And certainly Pep Guardiola will be looking to add more trophies to his haul. And I would say Manchester City certainly are in the driving seat there because you would fancy them to score again. Real Madrid have a wonderful history. Nobody has won the Champions League more than Real Madrid, and Zidane would love to get a fourth title. But it's a difficult one, especially after the team's coming back from the lockdown. It depends on their focus, and playing behind closed doors is difficult for players. I know that. So it's not an easy one to call, but Manchester City, I think, have a slight edge.
On Zidane, this is a ludicrous question to ask, obviously, given what he's achieved as a manager. But he's never talked about as a great tactician, and sometimes people wonder, well, what does he really do day to day? To your eye, Zidane as a manager, tactician, how he manipulates a team, how he maybe makes substitutions and changes games, what's your sense of how good this guy is? Because his record, obviously, is ridiculous, but there has been the question mark over, you know, maybe in a way Ancelotti gets this as well to a point, you know, what, how much are you doing day to day?
It's a good question, Joe. Actually, you know, and I've watched Zidane for many, many years. I loved him as a player. Mm. He was a fantastic player, but you and I both know just because you're a great player doesn't mean you're going to be a great manager. And that was one of the questions, but he seems to command so much respect, and he seems to be obviously know his players and pick his players and get the best out of his players. You know, I was chatting to a TV company in Asia this morning and talking to them about Johan Cruyff and what he could deliver, and he was a wonderful player as well, but he was also a really good tactician, and he wanted to play attractive attacking football, which is, you know, the ethos of Real Madrid. They want to play attacking football, and they have the players to do it. So he'll give them the confidence and belief in themselves to go out and play. That's why you can never, ever rule them out. I think anybody who rules Real Madrid out are foolish, but you know, it's hit and miss with them, and especially after a lockdown situation.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we're talking Cruyff. Cruyff's a visionary. Zidane, for a start, you wouldn't say Real Madrid play exhilarating football by the standards that they might be expecting, you know, the fans. It's pretty rudimentary at times and hard to beat at times, no?
It is. I mean, I'm still trying to work out. I thought Gareth Bale would have had a run out yesterday. I thought he had a chance of playing, and you know, he didn't. He was sitting on the bench, and you know, the press seemed to pick on him a lot, but he doesn't seem to care. They've got some very, very good players. Marco Asensio is the New Yorkan player who was over the cruciate ligament injury, and he's played in quite a few of the games, but he came back straight from an injury after being out for like 4, 5, 6 months, and he's scoring goals. He's actually put the ball in the back of the net. He's, you know, and he's back to his normal form. So he seems to know, or has a gut feeling about a player, whether he's 100%. I think that's what it is. It's an instinct on the player as to whether he's up for it or not.
Okay.
And he's been pretty good so far, I have to say.
Well, his instinct on Bale is pretty clear. I mean, this is just a conundrum at this stage. Bale, by the way, is still, I was reading, Guillaume Balaga had a piece, he's still the fifth highest goal scorer at Real Madrid in the 21st century. So Gareth Bale has still, in so much as he may be labelled a bit of a flop over there, has still scored 105 goals for Real Madrid in 250-odd games. He's going to win his second La Liga title. And at that moment, Jerry Armstrong is gone. You're gone, Jerry, I presume. I'll finish my point anyway and we'll take a short break. But Bale is about to win his second La Liga title. He has 4 Champions League medals to his name. 4 Champions League medals to his name. And maybe scored the greatest goal in the Champions League final against Liverpool. It's up there with Zidane's, potentially. And it just seems like he's been cast aside, really. So you may not have seen it. He was pretending to be asleep in the stands against Alaves. He had a mask over his eyes and he got slammed by the press. And then at the most recent game, he wasn't brought on as a sub. He's been on the bench for the last 5 games in a row. He was pretending to watch the game through binoculars as some kind of a joke. and the press are all over him. But it seems he's going to sit it out, is the point. 600 grand per week, his contract expires in 2022. So that's the general situation with Bale. I'm told you're back, Jerry, are you?
Yes, I am back.
Right, OK. Sorry, well, sorry, I've been rabbiting on to myself here and the listeners just explaining the Bale situation. I won't repeat all of it. In short, I highlighted how, on paper, his Madrid career is stunning. Four Champions Leagues, etc., second league title. There's the stuff, you know, him pretending to be asleep. There's him watching the game through binoculars. The press don't like him, clearly. Yes. Zidane has had him on the bench the last five games in a row. They wanted to sell him, it seemed, at the start of the season. You just don't really understand, I don't anyway, why this thing hasn't quite worked out the last couple of years.
Oh, well, last summer he was due to go to China. It was a big deal. He was going to earn £1 million a game, or €1 million a game. And they were losing 2-0 in a pre-season game. I was actually commentating on it. And they brought Bale on in the second half. He scored a goal and made a goal. And he turned it around for them. So the president and the rest of the directors said, no, he's not going. The next day, and they pulled the plug. So I don't think Gareth Bale was too happy on that. He still has another 2 years left on his contract. He said, look, I'm happy to sit out the rest of the 2 years of my contract. So something's going to have to give, but Bale isn't budging at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, OK, 600 grand a week is nice, Jerry. Neither you nor I would turn it down. But like, for if Bale spends the next 2 years, he's still, you know, of an age where he could produce quality football. If he was to just sit out the next 2 years, effectively, you know, playing a game here or there, what a waste of talent that would be.
I agree. It wouldn't suit me. And when I've been in that situation before, I always wanted to play. But I don't know what sort of a person he is in terms of, is it a game of cat and mouse where he's trying to get them to break first, whatever. I don't know. But certainly, you'll see there should be some movement when the season's over now in terms of where he's going to go. I think if he's going to go, he'll go in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, it feels like it's coming to a head. Well, Real Madrid are going to win a league title. It's Bale's second. Jerry, thanks a million.
They are. Thanks very much, Joe. That's good to speak to you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Jerry Armstrong there. So Real Madrid play tomorrow. That should be it, done and dusted. Still Arsenal 2, Liverpool 1. Ronan Mullen's been keeping an eye on this game. We'll get to Ronan in just one sec.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. When you've done your hammer during PE with Joe, relax. The football's back. Gamble responsibly. See dunleary.net.
Now you're welcome back. Don't forget, by the way, on Friday we've got our Know Your Football quiz. It's a rollover prize this week, €2,000 up for grabs. It's happening Friday, 1 o'clock. You can register at quiz.otbsports.com and log on before 1 o'clock Friday. Answer all 15 questions correctly and the cash is yours. Know Your Football, brought to you in association with Paddy Power. Check out paddypower.com and visit dunleary.net for information on responsible gambling, dunleway.net. Ronan Mullen, hello.
Joe, how are things?
Very well. We spoke nearly 3 hours ago, Ronan. You've been spending some of that time watching Arsenal 2, Liverpool 1, 79 minutes in the clock. I was trying to explain to people just how bad the Arsenal goals were from a Liverpool perspective. I'm not even sure I fully did it justice.
No, and in the last 10 minutes, just as an example of the pattern of play, I think the last 10 minutes, 92% possession for Liverpool. But as you said, the goals that they gave away, it's kind of Van Dijk's, for example, his game is almost defined by his nonchalance a little bit, isn't it? Like that languid style where it almost seems too easy for him at times. And this is one of those examples where he turns to play it back to the goalkeeper and gets intercepted by Lallana. And the second for Arsenal, again, Liverpool, the detail of their throw-ins is well covered, that they have a throw-in coach and all that goes with that. And again, that was their undoing for the second goal. So as much as they played a full-strength team against Arsenal, who made five changes with an eye on the FA Cup semi-final, I presume. Like, and boxers tell me this time and time again, you can have the preparation as like down as you want and all this kind of stuff, but even subconsciously, Liverpool, barring a points record, they're not really playing for much and the job of work is done for them, you know?
Yeah. And have they generally been on top, Liverpool, in the game? Yeah. I mean, I know you said about the 92% possession the last couple of minutes. Generally, the two crazy goals aside, have they been on top?
Yeah, it's all been one-way traffic. I think Arsenal, even shape-wise, they didn't seem to be playing with a recognised striker in the second half, at least the bits I saw. So Arsenal probably didn't expect to find themselves in this position. But again, they're not exactly playing for much in the league, but they do have that big semi-final. Man City, obviously, in action today as well. So those two square off the weekend.
For all Van Dijk's brilliance and the notchalance that you mentioned, he very rarely makes a mistake. You know, the notchalance seems to work quite well for him. I can't think of too many other times where he has, in a position like that, just turned around and passed it to an opposition player and been directly responsible for a goal.
Yeah, it's almost the beauty of the way he plays, and I can't remember a centre-back with a higher approval rating in the last, probably since Maldini. You know, like, I think everyone would have Virgil van Dijk rather, as their number one centre-back in their team. So, yeah, to see those mistakes is rare. But then again, I saw one of these compilations, I'm sure you've seen them, of Harry Maguire and his copious mistakes. I think it was set to, like, Benny Hill music just to compare things. But then someone posted a reply under that saying, you can do this with any player, and they put together a video of Van Dijk making a few errors. So I suppose Liverpool fans would be more au fait that, like, every player makes mistakes, but his just seemed to be few and far between.
Yeah. So Arsenal have hung in there, you know, in a very un-Arsenal way, we can say. Arteta is trying to change the culture at the club slowly but surely. This has the look then of a resolute, backs-to-the-wall kind of performance.
Yeah, and you'd have to think that maybe the Klopp template is one that Arteta will look at, because obviously Liverpool didn't have huge swathes of cash to throw at the project when Klopp arrived, but he, as you said, changed the culture, got a squad that he was happy with, and then was able to make those key additions that tipped them over the top. And I'd say in a couple of years, if Arteta's still there, and there's no reason to suggest he won't be if Arsenal give him the backing privately that they're giving him publicly. So I think, again, he'll be hoping that he could probably follow Klopp's line a little bit. I'm sure there's a few teams hoping to do that. Manchester United, similarly. Solskjaer trying to, he cleaned house last summer, and again, all the signings have been good so far. So Arsenal, whether they can open the checkbook, it's obviously defined that club in the 12 years or so since they moved into the Emirates that they haven't been awash with revenue. But I think every club's in the same boat now in that regard. So it'll be interesting to see how things play out for them.
Salah's just coming off. Firmino's already gone off for Liverpool, about 8 minutes on the clock. Arsenal, as they have done a lot of late under Arteta, are three at the back. It would seem because Arteta doesn't really feel he has two good enough centre-halves to do the job, including this evening, David Luiz, who kicked off Project Restart against Man City in the most calamitous fashion. He's looking a bit better this evening, I take it.
Yeah, and in what many games can you say that David Luiz has put Virgil van Dijk in the halfpenny place? But that is the case tonight, Joe. And, you know, Pat Nevin made the point last night. He is quite a good player on his day. He just has these crazily calamitous errors in his locker, and too many to mention is the real issue. But, like, you don't get to play for Chelsea and win Champions League with them, and then PSG, obviously, as well, back to Chelsea and Arsenal. So he's presided at the top of football for a decade plus. So there's a reason for that. And you see it today, kind of marshalling things in a bit of a backs-to-the-walls effort, so...
Presided.
He's still got.
You said he's presided. He's been part of it. I don't know if he's presided. We'll say he's been part of it.
Joe, he has lauded it over the other 21 players in that team.
Listen, good stuff. Thanks for that update on the game. Cheers.
Cheers, Joe.
Ronan Mullen there. Arsenal 2, Liverpool 1. Liverpool on top, as Ronan was saying, but Arsenal are in the lead with 7 minutes to go. I was about to say they're going to come away with 3 points. They are far from that stage with 7 minutes to go, plus out of time. We're pretty much done for the evening. OTBAM back with you tomorrow morning, 7:30. Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, John Giles on the show. Also, though, we will have Crystal Palace against Manchester United, Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr on commentary for that game. As ever, if you missed anything, you can get the Off The Ball app. Just search OTB Sports in your app store and you'll find us there. Tom Dunn is on the way next. Good luck.
The OTB Podcast Network.